Sean, welcome back to Planetary Radio. You made Time Magazine.
Indeed we did, Matt. We were listed as one of Time Magazine's top 50 inventions of 2009, which pleased us and surprised us a little. Of course, our spacecraft was invented some years back. We launched in 2004 and have been flying for 5.5 years. But what I think Time was recognizing was that we had to make a number of innovations to fabricate a spacecraft that would fly as close to the sun as we must do to reach Mercury in terms of materials, in terms of thermal design, in terms of protection, autonomy. And it's only in the last 2 years that all of that design work was shown to be just what we needed. So I view Time's mention of Messenger as a nice validation of our engineering team and all the work they did to make a spacecraft that could survive as close to the sun as 70% of the distance from the Earth to the sun.
You know, this is something that has only just occurred to me, and I won't even remember the name of the other mission, but I just read this week about plans for a new mission that is going to get pretty close to our home star, and I wonder if maybe they've learned some things from you and your folks.
Indeed. I think you're probably thinking of the Solar Probe, which is a mission concept that NASA is now working on and will soon be calling for instruments. And that spacecraft is going to fly much closer to the sun than even Messenger does and try to understand all of the physics that goes on as the solar wind is accelerated near the sun and begins its long journey out past all of the planets to the outer reaches of the heliosphere. And indeed, a lot of the technology that went into Messenger and that was tested for Messenger is the starting point for the design of a mission that's targeting the sun, and we'll have a very challenging environment even compared to what we're experiencing.
I'm not a bit surprised. Indeed, you are closing in on 2,000 days in space and 4 billion miles or 6.5 billion kilometers, and yet the best is yet to come. Tell us what happened just a few days ago that kept you on course for orbit around Mercury.
Right, Matt. Between almost all of the planetary encounters, and we've now had 6 of them since we launched, there is a major propulsive event, what we call a deep space maneuver. That's been planned from the outset as a way to retarget the trajectory of the spacecraft from the path it's taking after the most recent flyby toward the next flyby. There have been 5 in all. And last week, we completed the 5th and final deep space maneuver. So we are now on target to encounter Mercury for orbit insertion in March 2011. But let me tell you how good a job our mission design and navigation team did at threading the needle for that deep space maneuver. We are now on track to encounter Mercury to within about 170 kilometers of our aim point. And that aim point is 16 months away. We've got to go around the sun many times. And yet we already can project that we're going to come in very close to where we want to be. And furthermore, the team has become very experienced at making small changes to the trajectory of the spacecraft by a technique known as solar sailing, in which they tilt the spacecraft or they reorient the solar panels and use the radiation pressure from the sun, bombardment of the spacecraft by photons, to make small but continuous changes in the trajectory of the spacecraft. And so this distance that we are now estimating we are from our aim point is easily correctable over the rest of the trajectory by solar sailing. So this is the last event. It's behind us. We're right on track, and we're exactly where we want to be for orbit insertion in March of 2011.
Well, thanks for the proof of concept for solar sailing, since the Planetary Society, and we should say the Japanese Space Agency, hope to emulate your solar sailing next year. Tell us about the third and final flyby that was just last September 29th. Some scary moments, but you did pick up some science and some beautiful new images.
Indeed, Matt, your notes are very complete.
all from your website.
The scary moment was a safe hold. As we were approaching the planet, just about 4 minutes before closest approach, we lost contact with the spacecraft. The signal disappeared. And we were in eclipse, so we were on battery power. We were about to be occulted by the spacecraft, meaning that the line of sight between the spacecraft and the Earth was about to disappear as Mercury passed in between the two. But we were still in contact, and we lost communication. And it was only after the eclipse and after the Earth occultation that we learned what had happened. There was a configuration in one of the autonomy rules that tracks battery discharge during a solar eclipse that led the spacecraft to decide that it needed to switch power distribution units. We have a redundant power system. It made the switchover, but that switchover by our autonomy rules puts us in a safe hold mode. And what that does is it keeps all of the science data we've acquired, but it stops the command sequence, the set of commands that govern the acquisition of new science data. So from that safe hold until we recovered more than a day later, we stopped taking science data. And so a lot of the observations that we had hoped to take during the flyby were not, in fact, made. That said, we took all of the data we planned up until 4 minutes before closest approach, and those closest approach data gave us a view of new parts of the planet. They gave us a variety of observations of the planet's atmosphere and some new observations of how Mercury's magnetosphere behaves in response to variable solar wind conditions.
I'm beginning to think that these safe-in experiences are a rite of passage for most deep space spacecraft, but I'm sure it was still a very tense moment there in your control room.
Well, take the following view. Messenger spacecraft, which is near Mercury, is sometimes on the opposite side of the Sun from the Earth. Mercury can be as far as 1.5 times the Earth-Sun distance away from us. And that means that the one-way radio time from the spacecraft to the Earth can be as large as 12 minutes.
Hmm.
Because we're so close to the Sun, if something unexpected happened and it went into a tumble, we believe that under an arbitrary tumble, an arbitrary axis of rotation and speed, that our spacecraft could survive 30 minutes, but under the worst conditions, no more. And so if the two-way radio time between the spacecraft and the Earth is 24 minutes, which it would be on the opposite side of the Sun, there's not enough time for us to detect that kind of anomaly and command the spacecraft to correct itself. And so a spacecraft like Messenger must be autonomous. It must have a set of rules that protect the spacecraft under foreseeable anomalies. And those autonomy rules have to be conservative. They have to act to preserve the spacecraft. And sometimes that means, you call it a rite of passage, but sometimes it means we have to sacrifice a few of our scientific observations to ensure, in a conservative manner, that we are protecting the spacecraft.
I know everybody loves to start with the images. We've talked about this in the past, but your spacecraft is doing much more than that. That includes your field of magnetism.
It does include magnetism, and what we saw during the third flyby was a different interaction between Mercury's magnetosphere and the solar wind. Just to give some context, the first time we flew by Mercury in January of 2008, the magnetic field carried by the solar wind, the so-called interplanetary magnetic field, was steady and in a direction that it let it flow smoothly around Mercury. And so the interaction between the solar wind field and Mercury's magnetic field was very, very modest, and there wasn't much energy transport between the two systems. The magnetosphere was very steady. And then in October of 2008, we flew by, and the solar wind field, which fluctuates in direction on a variety of timescales, was in the opposite direction. And instead of flowing smoothly around the magnetosphere, there was a very strong interaction between the solar wind field and Mercury's field, and a phenomenon known as magnetic reconnection, where energy is transported and field lines break and reconnect as they move around the planet. was extraordinarily high, 10 times higher than typical at the Earth. And we could see a pulsating magnetosphere as we flew through it, and we could see evidence of magnetic reconnection events in the tail that we flew through before we encountered the planet. Well, when we flew by in September of this year, we saw a third type of state of the magnetosphere. The solar wind field was not steady. It flipped back and forth in the important direction, north or south, for these interactions. And what we saw was an extreme condition that we've experienced at Earth, known as magnetic tail loading, where magnetic energy from the solar wind builds up in the magnetic tail of a planet to a point where it is released suddenly in a magnetic substorm. And this phenomenon is much more extreme at Mercury than at the Earth. First of all, it happens much more quickly. On the Earth, the time scales for these magnetic loading and unloading of energy in the tail are in the range 1 to 3 hours. But at Mercury, the time scale is 1 to 3 minutes.
Wow.
Much, much faster, nearly, well, a factor of 60. But equally importantly, the amount of energy stored in the magnetic tail is so high that most of the energy in the system, for a time, is in the tail. And what that means is that on the opposite side of the planet, the day side of the planet, the magnetosphere loses most of its ability to stand off the solar wind. So during these kinds of transitions, the surface of the planet tends to be exposed to direct bombardment by the solar wind.
Mm.
This has great implications for the generation of the atmosphere and for the space weathering of the surface. So we've been really fortunate. The magnetosphere of Mercury is extraordinarily dynamic. It's the most responsive of all the planets to changes in solar wind conditions. And we've seen three different snapshots that are all very different. And what they promise is that we're going to have a great show when we get in orbit around the planet.
What an incredible environment this poor little planet has to exist in. But what a great place to study all of this. What other data would you like to tell us about?
Well, we took some great observations of the atmosphere. I've talked about the atmosphere before. Most of the species in Mercury's neutral atmosphere come off the surface. And so what we're seeing are the products of micrometeorite bombardment and this solar wind bombardment knocking atoms off the surface of Mercury. So we're learning something about what Mercury is made of, and we're watching the outcome of these very dynamic processes interacting with the surface. So the second messenger flyby detected a species that hadn't been seen before from Earth. That's magnesium to go along with calcium and sodium and hydrogen and helium and oxygen and potassium. The third flyby we looked for and found ionized calcium. The reason that's important is that calcium has a relatively short lifetime as a neutral atom in the exosphere under ultraviolet radiation from the sun. It is ionized much faster than the other species. And so if we look only at neutral calcium, we get only a partial view of how that atom is behaving. So we now have maps of the distribution of ionized calcium and can put together the rest of that story. The other new observation we made about the atmosphere was to see how strong the variations of some of the species are with Mercury's position relative to the sun. The abundance of sodium in the anti-sunward tail that streams 100 planetary radii or more in the anti-sunward direction from Mercury was down this time by a factor of about 20 with respect to the abundances that we saw in the first two flybys. And this is informally called a seasonal effect on Mercury. It's expected on the basis of variations with solar distance. It's been seen to a limited extent from Earth-based observations, but we're now documenting these variations in much greater detail. And interestingly, some of the other species that we've mapped in multiple flybys now, including calcium and magnesium, don't show the same seasonal variations that the sodium do. And so it's a more complicated picture than a simple dependence on solar distance, and there's a mix of processes that contribute to the different species in the exosphere. And the fact that these species have different temporal variations is going to be an important lever for us to go after which processes are contributing most to which components of the exosphere. So it's another way of viewing this very complicated planetary system where the species are coming from the surface. They're in many cases knocked off the surface by solar wind processes, which are controlled by the interaction of Mercury's magnetic field with the interplanetary magnetic field, and all of these are affecting what we can see at Mercury's surface.
And the images, they are starkly beautiful, but one might be tricked into thinking that this planet is a dead place and not the incredibly dynamic environment that you've been describing.
Well, we love our pictures, and it is a stark landscape, to be sure, with no visible atmosphere and no none of the landforms that are formed by water and wind and those kinds of processes on Earth and Mars and perhaps Venus. But yes, every time we've taken new images, we've learned new things about Mercury. What surprised us this time was that the fraction of area that we saw for the first time at close range from spacecraft was only 6% of the planet. So we went in thinking that we wouldn't see that much that is new. we were just the last icing on the cake, the last diminishing returns of coverage. And boy, were we surprised. You were alluding to a couple of very unusual features that we saw. One was a two-ring basin, or a peak ring basin, about 300 kilometers across, a little less. We've seen one of those before, and the one we saw on the first flyby, which has the name Radit Ladi, is a fairly young feature with smooth planes in its interior. But we couldn't tell whether the smooth planes were the product of melting during the impact event or perhaps volcanic flows that came after the impact. But with this new basin that we saw on our third flyby, there's really strong evidence for later volcanism. And here's the evidence. First of all, the interior planes are not a uniform color, as you'd expect if you just melted the target rock. The planes inside the innermost of the two rings, the so-called peak ring, are a very different color from the rest of the basin and from the planes between the peak ring and the outer rim, that annular planes. So it's different in composition by inference. Moreover, you can determine the relative age of those different planes and of the basin itself by counting the density of younger craters that are superposed. And the planes inside this newly seen basin are clearly younger than the basin itself. And so to be younger means that they have to form later, by some later process, to be a different composition, really puts a finger on volcanic events. And this is a basin that may be as young as 1 or 2 billion years old. So our old notion that Mercury had a volcanic past, but most of those volcanic deposits were laid down 3.5 to 4 billion years ago, has really been overturned. And now we've got evidence that volcanic activity, at least in places, continued two times as recently as 1 billion years ago. So the planet is turning out to be much more interesting and to have a much more extended history of internal activity than we appreciated. That is really causing us to rethink all of our ideas about how the planet cooled and what were the conditions that were capable of generating lavas at the surface, and what that means about what the planet is made out of.
A fascinating planet and a fascinating conversation that I've allowed to go far longer than we'll be able to use as part of the radio show, but with luck we'll be able to post the entire conversation on the website and direct our listeners there to hear much more. You mentioned another image, and I did see one on the website that I thought was fascinating, a candidate for a possible volcanic vent.
That's right. During our first flyby, we imaged the first good candidate for individual volcanic centers. Now, Mercury doesn't have huge volcanoes like Mars or the Earth. The features that can finger a volcanic event have to be more subtle. But what we're looking for is a irregular depression, irregular and therefore not circular, not formed by impact, that doesn't have any of the other characteristics of an impact crater, that is surrounded by deposits that appear to be younger than the terrain on which they sit, that are draped over older landforms, and perhaps have a distinctive color and composition. And those characteristics were first seen in the first flyby. Notably, there were a number of modest-sized vents up to maybe 50 kilometers across at the outer edges of the Colores Basin. And there were a few other candidates that didn't quite have the full list of characteristics that were seen elsewhere on the planet. But as you noted from our website, this last 6% of the surface that we imaged during the third flyby contained what may be the largest, I should say, set of volcanic deposits that can be traced to a distinct volcanic center or vent. There's an irregular depression maybe 30 kilometers across that seems to be the source for deposits that are unusual in color and that extend as much as 100 kilometers from the vent. So we've got a set of deposits that's 200 kilometers across, more or less, that appear to have been derived from a rather large central vent. It's very bright. It's very distinctive in color. It's an area that was, in fact, seen first from Earth-based photographs at very low resolution of the surface of Mercury, but for the first time by amateur astronomers, who pointed out, suggested it might be a very young impact crater because such an impact crater is also seen to be bright, but it doesn't have the characteristics of an impact feature. It's very close, by the way, to this basin that has some of the youngest volcanic plains on the planet. Whether there's some temporal association that we can work out on to figure out when these deposits were laid down. But these explosive deposits, pyroclastic deposits that are associated with explosive volcanic eruptions, not only make these distinctive landforms, but tell us something very important about Mercury's interior. To have these kinds of deposits laid down, to have these kinds of explosive volcanic eruptions requires, if our Earth and lunar experience can guide us, requires eruptions where there are volatiles in the magma, because volatiles like carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, water, the interplay between the volatiles, particularly as the magma is rising and pressure is being lowered on the magmas, and the volatiles tend to exsolve or come out of the magma. They form bubbles. They exert tremendous pressure on the magma as it's trying to erupt. That pressure in a very complex way leads to explosive release of energy during the eruption process. So the signature of these kinds of eruptions on Mercury points to at least localized regions where the erupting magmas carried gases, volatiles, from great depths in the planet. That is a major surprise because Mercury was always thought to be a body formed at very high temperatures by very energetic processes near its parent star. The expectation was that water and other volatile species involving carbon and other gases would be extremely deficient, maybe even absent inside Mercury. And yet we're seeing evidence for volcanic eruptions that point to at least localized patches of these volatiles in the interior. So it's causing us to think very hard about all of our ideas for how Mercury got assembled and to try to come up with ways that at least parts of the interior might have had enough volatiles to support these kinds of volcanic eruptions. So Mercury is turning out to be a really fascinating place with a lot going on the time scale of minutes and hours and days, and a geological history that is much richer than was appreciated prior to these flybys and involves a planet that was assembled by processes that we're still learning new things about with each observation.
And I'm going to bet that all of this is reshaping how you will be doing science once you go into orbit, which is now not very far off.
It's not very far off, Matt, but as you might appreciate, when we're into orbit, things happen very fast. We've now had three flybys of Mercury that have produced rich sets of data of different parts of the planet, and we've learned a great deal from each of those flybys. But once we're in orbit, we are in a 12-hour orbit, so we're going to have the equivalent of two flybys a day for at least one Earth year. So that's 730 flybys. So in terms of data to be acquired, we're barely scratching the beginning of a huge amount of new information about a planet that's turning out to be more complicated, more fascinating, and incredibly richer in its history than we had any right to expect.
Sean, we will want to check in with you again, perhaps just before orbital insertion, as we build up to that many times amplified examination of this fascinating little world.
Happy to join you at any time, Matt.
And we will also put up the link, as we always do, to the official Messenger website, where you can find much more about everything that Sean has been talking about, including some very beautiful images and some pretty stunning animations as well of the kinds of dynamism that this planet experiences in its environment, which may be invisible to the human eye, except through the help of our computers. Sean, once again, thank you so much. And I'll just say once again that anybody who's hearing this as part of the radio show or the regular podcast will make sure that the entire interview is available as well, and you'll want to check that out. Sean Solomon is the director of the Department of Terrestrial Magnetism at the Carnegie Institution of Washington, but he has, as you've heard, been the principal investigator for this mission, the Messenger mission to Mercury, which will be entering orbit around that planet, the first spacecraft ever to do so, after already having shown us much more of the planet than we have ever seen before up close. That'll be happening in 2011.